Welcome to the 2012 edition of Hanukkah Lights, readings for the holiday season with Susan Stamberg and Murray Horowitz. On this year's show, we'll hear The Latke Maven by Gerald Shapiro, Cambridge 1975 by Joan Ligand, Geek Week by Rebecca O'Connell, and Rededication by Danit Brown, all on Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
The Latke Maven by Gerald Shapiro.
At times it seemed to Michael Edelman, aged 9, that his entire purpose in life, his reason for being, was to hand out misinformation about Jews to his classmates. This was in Kansas City, Missouri. The year was 1959, and in Michael's fourth grade class, he was the only Jew. His brother Ronald was the only Jew in the sixth grade. In fact, at Hartley Elementary School, the two of them represented world Jewry. Since nobody else in the fourth grade knew anything about Jews, Michael could say anything he wanted to. His grandfather died in September, and he had to skip a week of school to stay home and sit shiva with his family. At his teacher's request, he stood at the front of the room and explained it all to his classmates.
"Do you have to sit all the time?" his friend Dennis asked from the back row. "Yes, that's why they call it sitting shiva. What if you have to go to the bathroom?" "You hold it," Michael said, and crossed his arms over his chest. When you were Jewish, his stance seemed to imply, you didn't just get to go to the bathroom whenever you wanted to.
The Edelman family lived in an undistinguished neighborhood, populated mostly by Gentiles. Kansas City had a Jewish neighborhood of sorts, a small one, but it was across town where the houses were larger and the landscaping more impressive. Over in the Jewish neighborhood, some of their friends from Hebrew school had Hanukkah bushes at Christmas time, little fir trees festooned with dreidels and Jewish stars and tinsel. But Mr. and Mrs. Edelman thought that sort of thing was utter nonsense.
"Sure, there's a Santa Claus," Mr. Edelman had told his boys the year Ronald was 5 and Michael had just turned 3. "But I've got news for you. He's not going to be stopping at our house. He's going to skip us and go right from the Bowmans to the McCready's." He pointed toward the ceiling with his cigarette, as though Santa Claus might be on the roof.
"How come?" Ronald asked. "It's not fair. We have a chimney. We have a fireplace."
Michael felt tears swelling up behind his eyes.
"We'd make him cookies," he whispered.
"Because we're Jewish, that's why," Mrs. Edelman said, stepping into the fray. "You should be proud of that." She was very big on Jewish pride. Every fall, Michael had to stand at the front of the room and explain to his class why he'd be missing school for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. He felt a strange kind of power come over him as he spoke. He could have told his classmates anything. He could have said that Jews could fly, and they'd have whistled their admiration. Michael's teacher, Mrs. Grove, didn't know anything about Jews either, so she listened with the same rapt attention as everyone else.
"We march around the synagogue holding the Torah until the rabbi collapses," he told them all. "We can't eat for a week. Some of the weaker ones pass out, and we just step over them."
When springtime rolled around, he explained Passover, too.
"Matzah is made from cardboard, but we have to eat it anyway. It's just part of the religion."
In early December, it was time for Michael to once again explain Hanukkah.
"It isn't just about getting presents," he said. "It goes back thousands of years. The Jews were led by a family called the Maccabees, and they were at war with a mighty empire."
"What kind of name is Maccabee?" someone asked from the back of the room.
"It's Jewish,"
Michael fidgeted. He couldn't remember who the Maccabees were or who they'd been fighting against. Assyrians? Greeks?
The Romans, he said.
That immediately sounded wrong, but what difference did it make?
"The Romans had already defiled the temple and spilled stuff everywhere. But then Judah Maccabee and his brothers decided to fight back. And even though there were only a few of them, they managed to win. Then they had to clean the temple. They had to light the eternal candle again, but there wasn't any oil and they couldn't make any. So they lit the candle and it stayed lit," he said. "It was a miracle. It stayed lit for 8 days.
"I thought it was something about potato pancakes," one of his classmates said.
"Judah Maccabee invented potato pancakes," said Michael. "We call them latkes. My mom makes the best latkes in the whole world. She's the latke maven.
Unlike most of what Michael told his classmates, this last part was true. His mother had won best latke 2 years in a row at their synagogue's sisterhood fundraiser. What's a maven? Dennis asked.
It's like a queen. It's like she's the queen of latkes. He paused. If I asked her, she'd make latkes for everybody, and we could eat them right here in class. They're delicious.
Why had he said that? His mother didn't have time to make latkes for his class. What was he thinking about? She barely had time to cook dinner for the family. She worked as a secretary in a doctor's office on Meyer Boulevard, and when she got home at 5:30, she usually had a headache. That's a lovely offer, Michael, said Mrs. Grove. Are you sure she'd be willing?
After dinner that night, Michael cornered his mother as she was drying dishes and told her of his idea.
Latkes for your whole class, Mrs. Edelman said. She wiped her hands on a towel.
I told everybody. I said you make the best latkes in the world. It's the truth.
Mrs. Edelman smiled. My little angel, she said. She pinched his cheek. My doll.
You don't have to do it, said Michael. It's probably too much work.
I'll tell Dr. Wineglass I need the day off. He'll understand. This is important. They should learn about Hanukkah. They should know these goyim.
But the next Monday night, after dinner, Mrs. Edelman sat Michael down in the kitchen.
I can't do it, she said. I'm sorry, honey. I know I promised. Dr. Wineglass told me I have to go into work tomorrow after all. Gloria's out sick. I'm his best typist. He needs me.
I already told the class, Michael said. I told Mrs. Grove and everybody. I said you'd be coming tomorrow to make your famous latkes. She's expecting you.
His mother paused. Her face grew old. Do you want me to lose my job, she asked.
Of course he did. Before she went to work for Dr. Wineglass, she'd always been in the kitchen when he and Ronald got home from school. She'd have milk and cookies ready for them.
No, he said after a moment. I don't want you to lose your job.
You'll make the latkes. I'll show you how.
Mom, he groaned, that's crazy. I can't make latkes. I'm a kid.
Oh, come on. You've watched me make them 100 times.
I wasn't paying attention, he said, and that was true.
Well, it's time you started paying attention, said his mother. And together, they got down to work. She showed him all of her latke-making secrets. As always, she grated everything by hand, weeping over the onions, grunting over the potatoes, then adding back a bit of the starchy water the peeled potatoes had soaked in, her secret ingredient, just before she mixed in the eggs and the matzo meal. Then she described for Michael in detail the way she fried the latkes, just how much oil to put in the pan, how long to let the first side brown before flipping them. She made him write it all down.
How am I going to explain this to Mrs. Grove? He asked in a mournful voice.
I'll explain it, his mother said. I'll just tell her the truth.
The next morning, Mrs. Edelman dropped Ronald and Michael off at school, just as she always did. But this time, she went in with Michael, helping him carry a couple of boxes that held her Westinghouse electric skillet, various utensils and dish towels, a bottle of Wesson oil, a jar of applesauce, and an enormous bowl full of latke mixture. When they arrived at Michael's classroom, his mother lifted the skillet out of its box and set it on one end of the big desk at the front of the room. She plugged it in, then helped Michael unpack the rest of the supplies.
There's nothing to it, she told him in a soft voice. You know just what to do. She turned to Mrs. Grove. I'm sorry I can't stay, she said. I have to go to work. But Michael knows how to make latkes. He'll be your chef today. Oh, Mrs. Edelman, Mrs. Grove said, really? Are you sure? We could just... He helps me out in the kitchen all the time, don't you, darling?
Snickering broke out around the classroom. Girls and boys were tittering, including his friend Dennis and a girl named Dory, whom he'd loved since kindergarten. He wished a hole would open up in the floor so he could jump in and die. That would be better than this. Anything would be better than this. Then his mother kissed him on the cheek, but very near his mouth, and the snickering grew louder.
I've got to go, darling, she said.
And then, just like that, she was gone. Michael stood silently at the big desk, looking intently at the skillet.
Michael, are you sure you can do this? Mrs. Grove asked.
Yes, he said solemnly. She told me how to do it.
He poured some Wesson oil into the skillet and waited for it to heat up, as his mother had instructed him.
"This is the sacramental oil," he said, "like Judah Maccabee used."
Then he scooped out a glop of the potato and onion mixture, which had discolored overnight and now was an awful shade of brown, and plopped it gently into the skillet.
"Gee, that looked like a lot of oil."
Then he plopped another scoop into the skillet, and another, and another.
"That was definitely too much oil."
He should have measured it more carefully. Immediately, the smell of frying latkes filled the room.
Concentrating as hard as he could on his mother's instructions, he opened the package of paper plates and laid out four of them next to the skillet. He put a plastic fork on each plate. Then, here was the scary part, he flipped the latkes in the hot oil. Some of it splattered, but the drops missed him. This was going to be pretty scary, he told himself. This was going to be hard.
The classroom was abnormally quiet. Michael sought out Dory's face and, to his delight, saw her staring back at him, rapt. In fact, everyone was looking at him. It was like standing up in front of the class explaining Yom Kippur all over again, except this time he had something to do with his hands.
"Okay, who'd like a latke?" he asked. Hands went up around the room. That's when it occurred to Michael that he needed someone to help him, a waiter. He couldn't do it by himself. "Who'd like to help?" he asked. No one raised a hand.
"Class," Mrs. Grove said in a chiding voice.
Michael unscrewed the lid of the applesauce jar as he waited. Still nothing. Michael lifted the first four latkes out of the skillet with the spatula and put each one on a paper plate. They looked greasy and fat. They didn't resemble his mother's latkes at all. He topped each one with a spoonful of applesauce, then scooped four more spoonfuls of the latke mixture into the hot skillet, where they sputtered in the oil. "Dennis," Michael called out, "can you help me, please?"
He'd known Dennis since kindergarten. They were best friends. They played together all summer every year. They threw eggs off the Highway 71 overpass together. Now Dennis reluctantly shuffled up to the big desk. "I'm not Jewish," he complained.
"I know. Come on, it'll take 2 seconds, please."
"You're Jewish," Dennis said. "It's your holiday." But he shrugged and retrieved the four latke-laden paper plates, two in each hand, and ferried them to the nearest row of students. Michael laid out four more paper plates. He flipped the latkes in the skillet, and this time drops of hot oil splattered his arm. Wow, that hurt. It hurt a whole lot. It hurt more than a whole lot. He'd seen his mother get splattered with hot oil, and it looked like it hurt a little, but this was worse. It felt like he'd been stung by a yellow jacket, a big one. He looked at his arm, and for a minute he thought he might start crying. He was going to be scarred for life. His arm was never going to be the same again. Nothing this bad had ever happened to him before. In fact, nothing had ever happened to him, period. "Are you sure you're all right, Michael?" Mrs. Grove asked.
"Yes," he said, and surprisingly, that was true. After a moment, the pain began to ebb a bit. He lifted the latkes out of the skillet, dripping with oil, put them on plates, and adorned them with applesauce. "Here you go," he said to Dennis, and Dennis shuffled off to deliver them. "Eat them while they're hot," Michael called out. "They aren't any good when they're cold."
"Yuck, they're greasy," one of the students called out.
"I know," Michael said. "They're not as good as my mom's." To take his mind off the stinging pain in his arm, he began to spin out a line of patter while he continued to fry latkes. It was what his mother would have done if she'd been there. He could hear her voice in his head as he spoke. "There have been lots of famous Jews," he said. "Jesus was Jewish. It's true. So is Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein! Jonas Salk is Jewish. Sid Caesar, Jack Benny, Milton Berle. Jewish, Jewish, Jewish. Sandy Koufax, the best pitcher in baseball, 13 strikeouts in one game. Jewish," he said, his voice rising over the sputtering sound of the oil.
And so it went. He kept pouring more oil into the skillet, and the latkes got heavier and heavier as he went. He didn't know what he was doing. At this point, he couldn't remember what his mother's instructions had said about the oil. He couldn't remember anything she'd said at all. He saw Dory hide her latke in her napkin and slide it into her lap.
Dory was never going to speak to him again after today. He noticed that a lot of students in the class hadn't eaten more than a bite. But when everyone had been served, Mrs. Grove called for a round of applause, and after a long moment of awkward silence, everyone in the class clapped, a tepid smattering of applause that quickly died out. Michael and Dennis each took a bow. "What are you bowing for?" Michael whispered to Dennis.
"I helped, didn't I?" Dennis said, "and it's not even my holiday." That night after dinner, Mrs. Edelman sat Michael down in the kitchen. "What do you want for Hanukkah this year?" she asked. "Ronald's already given us a list."
"I don't know," Michael told her after he'd thought a minute. "Let me think about it."
She noticed the puffy red spot on his arm where the oil had spattered him. "You are very brave," she said in an admiring tone. "My little Maccabee."
2 nights later, just before bed, he scratched the scab that had formed, and it bled a bit. But a week passed, and he noticed with great disappointment that the scab was gone, and nothing remained, not even an itch. He had hoped it would last forever. He was proud of it. A tragic scar, a memory of suffering, a testament to his bold exploits in the face of danger.
Cambridge 1975 by Joan Ligant. There were 20 of them in the room, and every one a rabbi's daughter. 1975, Cambridge, Massachusetts. A gathering for like-minded women to analyze and deconstruct and depedestalize, a new word, the experience of being female in the Jewish patriarchy. Which was not, of course, what the flyer had said. There, the meeting was described in bland, fungible terms. Rabbi's daughter, come meet other women who share your upbringing. Refreshments served. But the subtext was clear. Or clear enough to anyone who'd been hanging around the bookstores and cafes of Harvard Square those years. The ruling males had yet again ignored, belittled, and delegitimized their female members, slamming the doors of power in their faces. It was rampant, appalling, and something had to be done. At a minimum, its victims should get together, vent, and eat cake. I attended as a fly on the wall. The daughter of a union organizer descended from anarchist Yiddish poets who had no use for religion whatsoever. Pablum for the addle-brained who needed to believe there was more to the universe than meets the eye. I had been sent on assignment from a fusty Jewish women's magazine. Though sent was something of a stretch, I'd pitched the idea to the aging blue-haired editor in a series of relentless phone calls from the moment I saw the flyer on a rainy December morning in a dingy grocery on Mass Ave. Rabbi's daughters, I thought, squinting at the notice. It had never occurred to me that those grim-faced clerics even had sex, let alone children. But I was broke and needed the work. Plus, my curiosity was piqued. I'd inherited my father's distrust of dogma, yet there was something that drew me. Maybe it was the turmoil of the times, or the vague discontent I'd been feeling, a dim awareness that all those strident isms we'd been so fervently worshiping were not the sole holders of the truth. So, with the help of a neighbor who'd survived afternoon Hebrew school, I boned up on the basics, festivals and holy days, customs and ceremonies, and most strangely, otherworldly figures from legend and folklore, the defiant Lilith, the giant creature Og, and finally, the shape-shifting prophet Elijah, who comes to earth as a beggar, a woodsman, an old woman, to set things right before vanishing like a vapor. "Keep it short," the exhausted editor sighed on the phone. 800 words. My readers want soup recipes, not manifestos. I arrived early and set myself up in a corner. The women piled in noisily in hiking boots and overalls, bell-bottoms, Birkenstocks, hugging one another, making the high sign. In my cultural illiteracy, I had failed to notice it was the fourth night of Hanukkah, and some of the participants, in a show of solidarity with still socialist Israel, had brought jelly donuts instead of latkes, pastry the preferred holiday food in the more politically advanced Levant. After a litany of shared grievances was recited, the years relegated to serving tea after services, of sitting in the women's balcony, of being deprived of the stimulating Talmud study offered to even their most moronic of brothers, a string of wild victories were robustly hailed. Females were pressing the seminaries for equal admission. Feminists were regendering the liturgy. A brave group calling itself Count Us In was picketing area synagogues, picketing, demanding to be included in the minyan. Amid the applause and whistles, one participant dramatically rose from her beanbag chair in full male ritual regalia, floor-length striped tallis over her coveralls, the little black boxes of tefillin perched on her forehead and arm, its vaguely sinister leather straps snaking toward her shoulder. The women whooped and cheered and pumped the air. I kept to my corner, took notes, and finally yawned, because though spirited, the meeting was ultimately old news. Cambridge in those days fairly seethed with women fighting the good fight over a slew of identical issues. I'd watched them break the barricades at the law firms, seen them donning suits and getting MBAs just like the boys. They were becoming cab drivers and telephone lines people and dermatologists. And storming this latest bastion was nothing anyone who'd been spending her days in the laundromats of Inman Square couldn't already predict. But just then, in a corner of the room near the front door, a young woman I'd not seen before raised her hand. She must have slipped in during the shouting. The tefillin model had by then sat down. Soon there'd be coffee and dessert, 2 dozen puffy donuts that sat in their cardboard boxes like so many baby chicks. "May I say something?" the woman said tentatively, and stood. Long-sleeved blue blouse buttoned to the neck, dark skirt to her ankles, black stockings ending in a pair of black Oxfords, and, most tellingly, a wig. Not one of the expensive types made of human hair that sold for thousands, but a dull brown synthetic number, a nondescript page boy, which, burdened by the additional awkwardness of a little blue beret, seemed to be slightly askew, sitting at an angle on her small head. The woman was herself small, almost bird-like in her fragility, and no older than 21. Upon closer inspection, it was evident that she was also pregnant. The room went silent. Someone accidentally dropped a Birkenstock. "This evening has just been so wonderful," the young woman said in a feathery voice, "so wonderful that I would like to invite everyone to my house for tea, Erev Shabbos. I live nearby on Green Street, number 10. It'll be the last night of Hanukkah, and we can thank Hashem for the glories of this world and for bringing us together in his holy name." A stunned silence. Tea? Erev Shabbos? Hashem? Who was Hashem? I scribbled a quick note. Another name for God? No one had brought up God all night. It, or he, or maybe she, had seemed, well, irrelevant. Carefully, the young woman tucked her skirt beneath her and sat down. She folded her hands in her lap and smiled. There was something about her. She seemed almost not of this world. How could she have had such a wonderful time amid these air-pumping triumphalists while sitting there in her 18th-century clothes like someone out of a story by Sholem Aleichem? A throat finally cleared itself. The tefillin warrior. "Look, that's very nice of you, but I don't think tea is going to accomplish anything. No offense, but I'm not sure you share the progressive agenda we're discussing tonight." I made a note, progressive agenda. Then I looked at the woman near the door. She was still smiling. "Well, now, just a minute," the woman with the dropped sandal said, annoyed. "Don't we need to be a little more inclusive here? I mean, are we speaking for all Jewish women or just a few?" waving hands, clucking tongues. It was an intractable problem. Hadn't the movement been dealing with it for years? Pushing careers instead of honoring motherhood, privileging male professions over traditionally female ones, speaking for the educated white middle class while ignoring their sisters of color and lesser means. "Hey," someone yelled from the back, jabbing the air, "who's calling me educated white middle class? I resent that." "Oh, come on, let's be honest here," the person next to her snarled. Anyway, there was obviously a procedural error. The flyer should have been more specific. If the organizer had an agenda, she should have said so. "That's ridiculous," a redhead in a woman power t-shirt spat. "What else could this meeting be about? What, we're going to exchange recipes? Have a quilting bee? Share our dreams of becoming Rebbitzins like our mothers?" Our mothers," someone erupted. "It just so happens that many of our mothers are amazing women who've contributed to the Jewish people in their own right. Denigrating mothers, let's not fall into that trap." They shouted, pointed fingers in each other's faces, picked fights. The donuts sagged in their boxes like sleeping babies. Something made me glance at the door. The woman was gone. Quietly, I collected my things and slipped out. No one noticed. I looked up and down the darkened sidewalk. 5 slim candles flickered in a nearby window. A small miracle. Another Jew on this lonely Cambridge street. Then it struck me. I knew Green Street. It was in my neighborhood. There were no Hasidim at number 10 Green Street. There were no Hasidim in Cambridge at all. Still, the next afternoon I went to the address and rang the bell. The day was bitterly cold, and I wore gloves and a scarf and a hat. An elderly Hispanic woman came to the door. My Spanish was poor, but I managed to inquire if anyone else lived there, maybe a young woman newly pregnant. I put a hand on my belly and demonstrated, rocked an invisible baby. The old woman made a toothless smile. "No, no niños," she said to me. The skin on her face timeless and paper thin. "No señora here. I alone, an old woman alone." She smiled again, and I felt a shiver, an ache of the familiar, as if I was supposed to know her, as if I did know her, yet I was sure I'd never seen her before. Still, there was something. Rattled, I thanked her and walked down the steps. She closed the door, and I went to the sidewalk, then turned back. A window was open despite the biting cold, and then I saw the slightest breeze blowing the filmy curtain, though the air in the street was utterly still, heavy with the possibility of snow. But I saw it, I know I did, the curtain fluttering, a whisper of moving air, and felt for an instant a faint tap on my shoulder. Though, of course, no one was there. Then the feeling was gone, and the air was still as death. I left the street and walked home. It began to snow. I stayed in Cambridge one more year, but I never saw another flyer about rabbis' daughters. Soon after, things in my life began to change in unexpected ways, events I couldn't quite explain. Coincidences that seemed to be more than chance. And whatever slim certitude I possessed in those years started to unravel. I didn't know then what it was, and it's been a lifetime of waiting for it to happen again, except that everything I knew to be true began to shift, and I moved away to California. It seemed the right place to go. The blue-haired editor called me a few times. I had kept my notes, but I never did write that article. Geek Week by Rebecca O'Connell.
My safety goggles were steaming up. I took them off, rubbed them dry, and put them on top of my head. Then I went back to staring at the girl at the next lab station, the girl with the curly black hair and the creepily familiar smile. Pittsburgh is not that big a place, and you'd think that by now I would have run into her at the movies or the pool or the science center or somewhere. I never had. Not till today, the first day of Geek Week, the first day of Hanukkah.
Geek Week was the university's science camp for gifted teens. I was supposed to be learning about exothermic reactions, but I couldn't look away from Rachel. I had a cousin named Rachel Levine. She was 1 year younger than me and lived about 3 miles away. I'd never met her. I had Googled her. I'd seen her picture online. I'd never tried to contact her. The family weirdness was too deep for that. But here she was, at Geek Week, at the lab station next to mine.
"Are you going to talk to her?" asked Dan, my lab partner. "Or are you just going to keep searing her with your heat vision?"
"It's not like that," I said. Dan shrugged.
"She's cute. You should go for it."
I shook my head. "She's my cousin."
"Dude, you are sick."
I felt sick. I considered backing away from the lab table, tiptoeing out the door, and fleeing Geek Week before Rachel figured out who I was. What if she was crazy, like her mother, my aunt? What if she hated me on sight because her mother hated my mother? What if she already knew who I was and was refusing to acknowledge my existence the way her mother had always done to mine?
"Hey, Rachel," said her lab partner,
and gestured at me with her graduated cylinder. Rachel put down her funnel and looked right at me. Hi, I said, brilliantly.
"Hello," said Rachel.
"Are you Rachel Levine?"
"Yes."
"I'm Kevin Gallagher."
"Pleased to meet you, Kevin."
Dan snorted. Rachel's lab partner giggled. But Rachel smiled at me. It was unnerving. I'd seen that smile on my mom's face and in my own school pictures. "We're cousins," I said. Rachel looked at me like I was an indicator strip dipped into an unidentified solution. "Our moms are sisters," I said.
"My mom doesn't have a sister."
Well, neither did mine, in a way. Something had happened. My mother and my aunt had had a fight. The rest of the family took sides. That is, the rest of the family took my aunt's side. My mom was ostracized, expelled from the family, along with me and my dad. I'd heard the story in bits and pieces over the years. I guess Rachel never had.
"Levine is a really common name. Maybe you're looking for a different Rachel Levine?"
"I'm pretty sure it's you. Is your mom's maiden name Greenbaum?"
"Don't answer him, Rachel."
My cousin's lab partner put her arm up to physically separate us.
"That's kind of a creepy question, Kevin. No offense." "It's okay, Sophie. Kevin, what makes you think we're cousins?"
"My mom's name is Rosalind Greenbaum Gallagher. She has a sister named Allison Greenbaum Levine. They're estranged."
"Got her," said Dan.
He showed us his phone where he'd Googled my aunt. It was a picture of Rachel with her parents from the same set I'd found when I started Googling them about a year ago. It was at her bat mitzvah. She had shorter hair then, but she still looked pretty much the same. She was standing in front of a bald guy and a chubby lady, my uncle and aunt.
"That doesn't prove anything," said Sophie, "just that you've been Google-stalking Rachel."
I had been Google-stalking her. I was curious. My mom sometimes gave me sincere, teary speeches. "I know you must wonder about the rift in our family. If you ever have any questions, your father and I will do our best to give you honest answers. I don't want to let family secrets fester." But I hated to ask. Mom hardly ever talked about her family without crying. Or getting a migraine. Or both. Usually both. So I'd turned to Google. My cousin was easy to find, not so easy to talk to.
"Why are they estranged?" asked Rachel. "If my mom and your mom are sisters, and I'm not saying they are, how come we've never even met each other?"
"I don't know," I shrugged. The way I'd heard it, my mom's family wanted nothing to do with us, which was fine, really, because they were all a bunch of lunatics. But I couldn't stand there and tell Rachel that, not at Hanukkah. Rachel leaned in and spoke softly, as if she didn't want the beakers and flasks and cylinders to hear.
"Maybe my mom has mentioned a sister. Maybe you are my long-lost cousin. Maybe the reason we've never met each other is because our mothers wanted it that way. Maybe we should respect that, and maybe you should quit asking about my family."
Rachel turned and went back to her lab station. She picked up her lab book and ran her finger slowly down the list of procedures.
Rachel, said Sophie.
My cousin didn't look up.
"We need hydrogen peroxide, 118 milliliters.
"Face it, Kevin," said Dan. "This is the effect you have on women."
Rachel kept her back towards us. As she measured and poured and stirred, her hair bounced all over the place. Rachel had the same springy, curly kind of hair my mom did. But my mom's hair was short. Rachel's hair was long. She's got hair like Holofernes, I muttered.
Dan nodded. I can see it.
Holofernes was the evil general who fought against the Maccabees. He was always shown with long, black, curly hair. In the story, Judith uses it to lift his head, which she's just sliced off with the general's own sword.
That's what I like about Hanukkah, said Dan. It isn't all about spinning dreidels and glowing candles. It's got decapitation, desecration, double agents.
Kind of like my family, I said. I took a few steps over to Rachel's station. She acted like she was preoccupied with her procedures, much too busy to see me standing there. Do you know what they fought about? I asked. That's one part of the story I never heard.
Excuse me, said Sophie, but some of us are here to do science.
Sophie, could you go to work with Dan? I asked. He knows nothing about chemistry. He's only here because the robotics camp was full. He needs you. Please?
It's okay, Sophie. Go, said Rachel.
Sophie strolled over to Dan's station, and Dan suavely dropped his pipette.
Obviously, whatever happened, it was big, Rachel said. Let's not stir anything up. Just try and get through Geek Week.
It wasn't just Geek Week. It was Hanukkah, and I was going to get to Rachel the way Judith got to Holofernes, but without the decapitation part. It's not like we had nothing in common. Did you light the menorah last night, I asked?
Yes. If you're going to interrogate me, at least help with the lab procedure while you're at it. We need sodium lauryl sulfate 60 milliliters.
Here. I handed her a bottle of sodium lauryl sulfate, dish soap. Was it a big brass menorah with places for the candles in front of two lions? Rachel finally turned and looked at me.
Yes. Why?
That's the same menorah my mom used to light when she was little. She told me about it, how she used to put in the candles, alternating with her sister, your mom. Rachel squeezed some dish soap into a little beaker.
Did you light the menorah?
Yeah. We used this one I made when I was like four at a paint-your-own pottery place. It's kind of embarrassing. Rachel poured the soap into the beaker of hydrogen peroxide.
My mom makes latkes with green peas mixed in.
Mine too, I said, almost shouted. I thought my mom made that up. For a second, Rachel grinned at me, a smile as bright as 8 Hanukkah candles, 9 with the shamash. I grinned back and said, hey, cuz. I guess that ruined it. Poof went the 8 or 9 candle smile, and she started rattling our lab equipment around.
Where's the yeast?
I found the little brown jar of yeast granules. Did you know that first cousins share 25% of their DNA?
Did you know human DNA is 96% identical to chimps?
Rachel took the jar of yeast from me. She scooped out what we needed and dropped it into a beaker of distilled water. I took a deep breath. Rachel, we're cousins. We're family. We found each other, by accident, on Hanukkah. Don't you think we should take that as a sign?
A sign?
Rachel could really get a lot of incredulity into her voice when she wanted to. That was also a little bit like my mom.
Are you telling me you're here at Geek Week looking for some kind of mystical sign? This is science camp. We're scientists. We're not into woo.
Rachel dumped the dissolving yeast into our beaker of hydrogen peroxide and dish soap. And that is when our lab station erupted. The stuff in our beaker fizzed, it foamed, blue-green bubbles geysered into the air, landing softly on our table, our notebooks, and our required safety goggles. I stared at Rachel. Rachel stared at me. She had a little tuft of foam on top of her head, like frosting. You look like a cupcake, I blurted.
You look.
I never did get to find out what I looked like. She was laughing too hard to tell me. I was laughing too, and snorting and leaning on the lab table to catch my breath from laughing so hard. Rachel gave me a thump on the back, a weak one, and her arm just kind of stayed there on my shoulder until Dan and Sophie came running over.
What happened? Asked Sophie.
What did you do? Asked Dan.
Rachel wiped her eyes and shook the bubbles from her hair.
That was not the predicted result, she admitted. Not with such a dilute hydrogen peroxide solution.
Were you using this? Dan grabbed our bottle of hydrogen peroxide.
Sophie leaned over his shoulder to read the label.
3%, just like ours, so why the big foam?
Dunno, I said.
I think I do, said Rachel. It must be a sign.
She took out her phone. She pressed a button.
Hi, Mom. Can we have latkes again tonight? I'm bringing someone over for dinner, okay?
Rachel put her phone back in her pocket.
Want to come over for latkes, Kevin? You're gonna love my mom's recipe.
I already do.
Rededication by Danit Brown. On the nights before show and tell at her daughter's elementary school, Mira would stay up late grinding chickpeas for batches of strong-smelling, gritty hummus and searing eggplant on one of the stove's gas burners for baba ganoush. This was, of course, before Middle Eastern food turned out to be good for you, and at her daughter's school, the other kids had regarded the dips, and by extension her daughter, with suspicion. And who could blame them? This was when her daughter was still named Anat, which was, she tearfully claimed, the worst possible Israeli name to have. Who wanted food prepared by Anat? It's a beautiful name, Mira had protested. But then again, according to her daughter, what did she know? Mira knew a lot, in fact, and she would have willingly, gladly even, shared her knowledge if only Anat would have, please, just for a moment, stopped complaining, please, please. Not that Mira didn't complain herself. Hannah, she'd scoffed when 10-year-old Anat had announced that she was changing her name for middle school. What kind of a name is Hannah? It's an old lady's name. Not here it isn't, Anat told her. Hannah, Mira said. Hannah Banana, Hannah Cabana, Hannah Savannah. She could have gone on, except that Hannah had rolled her eyes, already perpetually bored and unimpressed. Anat, now turned Hannah, had only been 3 when her family moved from Israel to Michigan, a fact that worried Mira no end. It was bad enough that Hannah's English was as clear and unaccented as any American's. But what about her ongoing fixation with all things red, white, and blue? Malibu Barbie, apple pies, hot dogs, Jell-O salads, even, God help us, Twinkies. Do something, Mira told Richard, and Richard, that poor fool, signed Hannah, good God, Hannah, up for Hebrew school, where it turned out you didn't learn all that much Hebrew after all, and where, as homework, you had to attend services at the local synagogue, something everyone knew actual Israelis simply did not do. And then, just when Mira was ready to admit defeat, her mother had come to visit, bearing a Barbie menorah for Hannah. There was Barbie, blonde and as skinny as ever, with her arms raised high over her head, supporting a metal bar onto which were welded 9 candle cups. But she's just for decoration, Mira's mother had cautioned. You don't want Barbie to melt from the heat. Still, surely, surely, a Barbie menorah was good enough for show and tell, wasn't it? As were the menorahs that followed. Kitty Cat menorah, Mahjong menorah, Michigan Wolverines menorah, Lipstick menorah, Moose Antler menorah, Gefilte Fish menorah, Christmas Tree menorah, Twinkie menorah. Soon the menorahs were coming not just on Hanukkah, but after each of Mira's yearly visits to Israel, on Passover and Rosh Hashanah, Thanksgiving and Halloween, even twice on Valentine's Day. You've got to be kidding, said Hannah, when on her 16th birthday she received a Hot Wheels menorah. Well, Mira said, you're the one who wanted a car. Hannah, by then a world champion of eye-rolling, rolled her eyes once again and made room for the new menorah on the set of shelves where Mira insisted on displaying all 36, now 37, menorahs.
Hannah might be able to hide behind a nasal Midwestern accent, but this way, anyone visiting her room, boys especially, would know she was, at the very least, a Jew. Once the new menorah was in place, Hannah locked herself in the bathroom and, in a vicious, premeditated act of revenge, plucked her eyebrows into thin lines and dyed her hair blonde. "Oh, my God," Mira said, "look at you. How will the others find you now?" Which was what everything always came back to. Mira's unwavering belief that gangs of roving Israelis were out there, wandering along the highways of the Midwest, looking for others of their kind. Mira was ready for them, of course, her overnight bag perpetually packed, at least metaphorically, her passport always within reach. She knew that if she held out long enough, these Israelis would show up and rescue her, returning her to the small moshav in Israel where she'd lived before Hannah's American father, Richard, had bewitched her, married her, given her Hannah, and then whisked them both away to a Midwestern town comprised entirely of strip malls and car dealerships. No wonder everyone hated Americans. And still, Mira worried. What was she supposed to make of the fact that Hannah regularly spent afternoons watching soap operas at her friend Mary's crucifix-filled house? Mary, like the mother of you-know-who. Or the fact that Hannah routinely snuck the cookies that Mira had banished to the basement during Passover, one time demolishing an entire package of Oreos that Mira had looked forward to eating herself just as soon as Hannah had gone to bed. And how about the fact that Hannah dated guys with names like Chris, and even, the summer after senior year, a sweet cello player named Jesus? And then, to make matters worse, Hannah went off to college and left all 43 of her never-used menorahs behind for Mira to dust. It was enough to make Mira find religion. Here was Judah the Maccabee facing down an army of angry Greeks and succeeding, you know, because he put his faith in God. And here was Mira, as secular could be, unable to face down the angry army of her daughter, or at least face up to the fact she was losing her, had maybe already lost her to America, and not just figuratively. These days, it took 10 hours of driving through a flat, relentlessly beige landscape just to see Hannah, who had moved to Indiana, of all places, to study cicadas, of all things. In Israel, Mira knew, Hannah would have never developed an interest in bugs or ended up so far away. She couldn't have. The country was just too bug-infested, and it was just too small. And then, out of nowhere, the first of three miracles. Two nights before Hanukkah, Hannah called, despondent because her larvae weren't behaving the way larvae should, the irony of which was not lost on Mira. "I miss you," Hannah reluctantly admitted. "I can't wait to come home." "Hallelujah," Mira told Richard. To Hannah, she said, "Get a hold of yourself." Still, she stayed up the whole night grinding chickpeas, then drove the 10 hours down to Indiana to see her homesick daughter because the semester break was still weeks away. By the time she'd arrived on campus, Mira had eaten her way through the entire supply of hummus, but that was okay. Even now, with all the Mediterranean diet hoopla, Hannah still wasn't a big fan. Children, they never know what's good for them. Along with the hummus, Mira had brought all 43 menorahs. It had taken her more than 2 hours to wrap them all in newspaper. But never mind. Hanukkah was Hanukkah, and even if it wasn't, she told Richard, they could happily gather dust somewhere else. "Mom," Hannah said, eyeing the empty hummus container in all five cartons of menorahs, "you shouldn't have." Still, she dutifully unpacked each box, lining the menorahs up in neat rows on her kitchen counters and then on the kitchen floor. Given how far Mira had driven, it was really the least she could do. That night they ordered a pizza, half pepperoni, half sausage, since they were Israelis and had nothing to prove, and watched the annual broadcast of The Sound of Music, because it featured romance and Nazis and lovely clothes. Then, after Maria and the captain hugged each other one last time against an alpine backdrop, Mira and her daughter went to sleep. But once she was in Hannah's bed, under Hannah's covers, Mira felt wide awake, restless. The night air seemed charged with static, the insects outside alert and angry, scratching out warnings with their bristly forelimbs. And then, shortly after midnight, there was a revving of motorcycles out in the parking lot and the sound of men laughing, followed by heavy footsteps clomping up the stairs. Mira picked up the phone and dialed 911. Finger poised over that final one, she listened as the footsteps reached the first floor landing, paused as if their owners were checking the apartment numbers, and then moved on. And suddenly she knew. It was them. Finally, at long last, the gang of roving Israelis. Somehow, they had found her, in Indiana, of all places, and now they were coming to return her home. Mira put down the phone and reached for her purse, unzipping the compartment in which she carried her passport. She was still in pajamas, but no matter. There was little time to lose. She padded out to the living room, where Hannah was asleep on the couch, oblivious. Out in the hallway, the footsteps paused on the second floor landing, then kept going. Mira hesitated next to her sleeping daughter, brushing a stray strand off of Hannah's face, then stooping to kiss her damp forehead. Up close, Hannah smelled warm and sweet, dizzyingly familiar. And then, right as the heavy footsteps reached Hannah's landing, Hannah stirred. "Mom," she said, blinking awake. When she saw that Mira was holding her purse and the passport, she sat up. "Mom, where are you going?" And then, in a small, scared voice, "Ima?" And just like that, Mira knew she wasn't leaving. She couldn't. Even if she could have left Richard, poor, sweet, darling American Richard, with his undying love for football and sprawling lawns, there was no way she could leave Hannah. Poor, sweet, darling, confused Hannah, with her dyed blonde hair and her horrid cicadas and her impossible eye rolling. Outside Hannah's door, the footsteps came to a stop. Mira tensed, waiting for the knock, but the knock didn't come. Instead, she heard the door opposite Hannah's creak open and a guy call out, "Dudes, it's the middle of the night!" before the door slammed shut again. Mira felt foolish. "I couldn't sleep," she told Hannah. Hannah got up, and Mira followed her into the kitchen and watched as she put water on to boil for tea. Who was this woman, this blonde stranger of a daughter, standing in front of a steaming kettle and 43 hideous menorahs that had never, not once, been lit? Suddenly, Mira couldn't stand it. "Do you have any candles?" she asked. Hannah did. She had 4 tea lights, a pair of tapers, and 3 value boxes of birthday candles that the previous tenant, a man well into his 90s, had left behind. And even though Hanukkah wouldn't officially start until the following evening, the two of them examined each menorah carefully before settling on Barbie, because all those years ago, she had been the first. It was a poor choice, and after a couple of minutes, Barbie started to buckle from the heat, her arms bending and threatening to spill her load of candles. But then, a second miracle, Barbie flexed her plastic arms with determination and continued to stand tall. Mira and Hannah exchanged glances, then wordlessly began placing candles in the rest of the menorahs. There were, in what was surely a third and final miracle, just enough to go around. Once they were done, Mira and Hannah stood back to admire their work. On the counters and along the floor, the 43 menorahs burned brightly. In ancient times, Mira realized, she would have never headed for the caves with the other rebels, would have happily sacrificed pigs at the altar, as long as it meant that she and Hannah could stay together. It wasn't something she was proud of, although, then again, maybe she was. She reached for Hannah's hand and squeezed, and, as if in approval, the candles flickered, and the light they cast on the walls and ceiling twinkled like a multitude of promised stars.
Hanukkah Lights, readings for the holiday season with Susan Stamberg and Murray Horowitz. All the stories you've just heard were commissioned by NPR and written especially for Hanukkah Lights. Rebecca O'Connell, who wrote Geek Week, is also the author of Penina Levine is a Potato Pancake and Penina Levine is a Hard-Boiled Egg. Joan Ligant, who wrote Cambridge 1975, has won numerous prizes for her short story collection, An Hour in Paradise. Gerald Shapiro, the author of The Latke Maven, also wrote three collections of stories and novellas, From Hunger, Bad Jews and Other Stories, and Little Men. And Anit Brown, who wrote Rededication, is also the author of Ask for a Convertible, winner of a 2009 American Book Award. Stories from past editions of Hanukkah Lights have been collected in an illustrated book called Hanukkah Lights, Stories of the Season. The book is available at the NPR shop, online at shop.npr.org, or at 1-888-NPR-DISC. To hear this year's stories again, along with stories from previous Hanukkah Lights programs, you can visit npr.org/holidays. Hanukkah Lights was produced and edited by Bruce Scott, with recording engineers Neil Tivolt, Chris Nelson, Kevin Waite, and Rob Beyer. Music was by Jorah Feidman from his recordings on the BMG and ROM labels. Thanks for joining us for the 2012 edition of Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
Happy Hanukkah, everybody.